The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes. Stomp.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Hey guys, Andy. Just a quick note. We were having some trouble with the call where there would be extended periods between when we talked and when Zach actually heard us talk and responded. I, of course, cut out those large silences, but I did leave a couple moments where we talked about them or mentioned them. So if you hear that and you wonder what we're talking about, that was it. Thanks.
Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and to my left is Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
The Honorable. Sarita the Edge Edgerton.
Represent.
And behind the glass Tative. Is Rocket Man. What's that?
Tative. Representative.
Representative. That was good. Behind the glass, Rocket Man Andy Bishop. We do not have Ralph Hicks. We do not have Billy Kimsey. We do not have Cherry Lewis. Although, I do have some news.
It's a skeleton crew.
It's a skeleton crew. But, and Tiziana Soberst was not able to be here tonight either. But great news. Cherry returns in 2 weeks. And she is meeting with me one-on-one. And she's sharing her testimony.
Bam!
And it's going to be
all 2 hours. We're getting all 2 hours.
Longer than that, probably.
Ooh.
I have to get
Yeah, that is a surprise.
Rent a room. So, yeah, I'm super excited that she's coming back. Billy is taking on all kinds of stuff.
Billy's getting wood.
If anybody wants
he
to
might
know,
be laying.
he owns
a lumber mill.
A lumber mill. Yeah, that's right. Sorry.
That's okay. Let's clarify that.
Context.
Yes. Very much. Especially in this group there, Andy. Yeah,
Careful.
Thank you.
So anyway, I'm very excited about that. We actually just got back. Rick and I just got back from the Arkansas Eschatology Conference.
Man, what a time. What a time.
Dude, there was 300. What do you call 300 preterists in one room?
Past tense.
Oh, nice.
Holy mackerel. That was.
I would say it's a history of preterists.
She's a representative tonight.
Yes.
For sure. No, it was awesome. It was very well ran. That's what really surprised me.
Smooth.
For their first go round. That was the biggest conference that they'd ever had.
Out of the first 15 minutes that they had a little hiccup with the audio, kind of like what we did today, a little bit.
Pretty much.
But other than that, it was
they resolved smooth. It on a grand scale because there was 300 of us sitting there like, come on, get it going, man.
Well, thank goodness it wasn't hot in that room.
Yes. It was very, very, it was very, very cool. And we had a lot of Burrow swag. We had a lot of people come up to
Sarita
us.
Sarita would not have a problem in that room.
People asked about you, Sarita.
Oh,
people
hi, everybody.
Asked about, yeah, people asked about Andy. Yeah, it was really
massive
cool.
Massive following Andy has. So just
it's
really
so crazy.
How many people asked about Greg? The only question I want to know.
Nobody asked about Greg.
Poor Greg.
Nobody asked about Greg. But our friend Austin and Danielle, he sent me a message. We had mentioned them on our little recap with Joel Rosenauer.
Yes, we did.
And he just sent a text like, hey, that was cool that you mentioned us.
And Austin said, and Danielle, golly.
But he said, I wish I could have met the rest of the Burrows, even Andy.
Bam!
So that tells you he's a listener. You know what I mean? No. So that's really cool.
He knows the gig. So that's awesome.
Well, anyway, my good friend, Dawson Wylop, introduced me to our guest via email, via text. And he is the author of two books that I see here. The one's called The Appointed Time, a commentary on the book of Daniel with a supplemental narrative of Jesus's Olivet Discourse. And then this most recent book that he released is called Unveiled, a first century narrative of John's revelation. So we have here author Zachary Ball. Hey, Zach, how's it going, man?
Hey, Rick, it's really a pleasure to be here. I appreciate this.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That I think we might have a little bit of a delay.
Yeah, it sounds like latency.
Yeah, a little bit of latency. But that's okay, because once he starts talking, it's going to be all him, baby. That's how it
works. Yeah, right.
So, So Zach, I'm just going to ask you the first question. This is a testimony episode. We'll get to your books at the end of the episode. I guess before I start, let me ask you this question. So Dawson is your friend. That's how we got introduced.
Yes.
This delay is brutal.
Yeah, I don't know that you phrased that as your answer needs to be in the form of a question. Dawson is your friend?
Dawson is your friend. Yeah, so Dawson.
Yes,
Dawson,
turn your head to the side. What do you do it?
So how do you know Dawson? Let's start with that.
So Dawson and I have been conversing over the last couple of years, but we met each other through Joel, actually, who you already mentioned. And what happened with Joel was that Joel and I connected through Facebook, through a preterist group, and he had shared some of his personal experiences relating to what was going on with him in his own church setting. And my wife and I reached out to him when we had heard that and said that we had gone through something similar. And so we had sort of a shared experience there that he and I began talking back and forth and just getting to know each other. And it sort of helps to have even the smallest support system around you, even though Joel and I have never met. But that's how he and I got to know each other. And then he had mentioned that there's another guy that I think you would get along well with. And his name is Dawson and lives a little ways from me, but that's how he introduced us. And then Dawson and I have engaged a little bit as well. And so that's kind of how we all came full circle there. And then Dawson was kind enough to let me know about your podcast, which I've encountered before, but just hadn't listened to too many episodes. And the rest is history, I suppose.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I love Dawson. Dawson reached out to us early on with an email, and it was so kind. It was just, he's such a kind guy. And he stays in close touch, yeah, with Joel. So that's really cool. I'm glad Dawson made this connection for us. So I'm going to ask you our first question, which is, to the best of your ability, can you tell me your earliest memory of when you heard the name Jesus Christ?
Yes. So I'm the product of an evangelical Christian mother and an atheist father. But my mom was faithful enough to take me to church from as early an age as I can remember. And I would say I was probably around 5 or 6 when I really heard the name Christ in my Sunday school. But it was around age 7 or 8 where I think I had my first spiritual experience or encounter, if you will, with realizing who Christ was. I had listened to the testimony of someone at a local church talking about their youth and their own experience with how Christ had guided them in the midst of everything they had gone through. And that testimony, for some reason, at age 7 or 8, even that testimony really reached into my heart. And my parents, even to this day, remember that I just went home that night and I just laid in my bed looking out the window. And there was something in me that I think Christ stirred up. And even from that young age, that was my first real moment where I can say that Christ infiltrated me, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I know a lot of people that have, you know, similar experiences at that age. So take us from there. So you're living in a home with a mother who's a believer, a father who's an atheist. So take us from there. I'm really curious about that dynamic. And then as you were being raised, you know, bring us from there to here. Take as long as you want.
Yeah, fair enough. I appreciate that. So my parents did get divorced when I was 7. A number of things, but obviously the religious component was a factor because my father always thought that I was being brainwashed going to church and the people around me. And so there was always some rough seas there, even into my teenage years with my father. But my mom did remarry to a Christian man, and we faithfully went to church through my youth, through my teenage years. I served in a number of capacities in the church, especially in the kids ministry. I did a lot of preschool and nursery, but then I kind of progressed into leading vacation Bible school. I sang in the church choir. I kind of did it all. And it was a great experience. I developed a lot of close friendships through our youth group, and it was just a great time and great growth for me. I went to college and had sort of the cliche college experience, if you will, where you just started doing things that were different than when you were growing up, different experiences. You tried new things, and you don't forsake the faith, but you just kind of walk away or you put it in the back seat for a while, unfortunately. And that was sort of my college experience. But I did meet my wife our freshman year there, one of the greatest parts of my college life. And I majored in history and political science while I was there. I do have a master's degree in history. I went to the University of South Dakota.
Okay. Wow.
It's probably one of the more prestigious ones in that area. It has the law school, the medical school, but the history department, I went through it, got my master's, but the job field in the field of history is very, very narrow. And you really have to know the right people and have the right credentials. That's exactly right. Yeah. And the problem on my end was that I didn't have the teaching certificate to be able to teach in high school, and I couldn't get into a PhD program, so I couldn't teach at college, a four-year university. So really all I can do is teach at the community college level.
I have a friend who's a historian and I think a master's, but not a PhD, loves history, absolutely loves history. He works in financial aid.
Yeah, I've worked in food my whole life, hospitality.
Oh, wow.
And that's actually what happened to me once I graduated.
There's a lot of history in the food.
It all comes together somehow. But I had, while getting all my degrees, I had worked for the food service management company at the university, and I had worked my way up. And upon graduating, they offered me a salaried position in a management role. And I was not going to lie, I was proud of that. I kind of got a big head about that and thought, oh man, well, as difficult as the job field is going to be, I could really have something here. And so I really began pursuing the career aspect of the hospitality industry. And truth be told, after about 3 years of doing that, a feeling of emptiness kind of came back over me, as what I was pursuing in the hospitality industry, I was pursuing nothing but what I thought I could get and what I thought would be enough, and everything that I had hoped for to maybe provide for my family in the future, and just things of this nature. And after a few years, it just produced a feeling of emptiness in me, and it brought me back to a place of faith. And I went into an office. I was on duty one weekend at the university, and I went into an office. I shut the lights off and I just prayed for a couple of hours. And that was sort of my adult moment, where I wouldn't say I like to use the word rededicated, but I sort of had my true realization of the dependence on Christ that had gotten away from me. And as an adult, that was my turning back around and putting my faith back in the driver's seat moment, if you will. And so that's sort of what happened. And after that, we got back into church, my wife and I, and got heavily involved. We spent the next about 15 years in an Assemblies of God denomination, which was new to me. I had grown up Presbyterian, but I had become the worship leader at the church. I was sort of my pastor's right-hand man. We led a lot of stuff in that church, and we became very close with people, and we enjoyed the freedom of the Assemblies of God, and we liked how they stood firm on their stances. And so there were some things we appreciated about it, but we didn't exactly see eye to eye on some of the theological aspects, but it was okay. And when we came out here to South Dakota, after a few years with an Assemblies, we moved out to Wisconsin here. And after about 7 or 8 years here, the senior pastor of the Assemblies of God church that we were attending up here, he and I began talking about starting some home churches, trying to get back to the roots of the first century church and developing some of that more community-based fellowship and service. And so I began leading a home church under the Assemblies of God umbrella, and there were a few of us doing that. And after a couple of years of doing that, one of the families that were a part of our fellowship here, I asked everybody, hey, what would you like to talk about this next year? What would you like me to teach on, prepare? And one of them said, we really want to do a study of Revelation. And absolutely everything changed.
Yeah, just the little stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, minor, you know, no big deal. The hardest book in the Bible. Yeah,
30-foot diamond board straight into the shallow end. Let's just go all the way.
Let's just do it, right? My goodness. And basically, that is the point where everything changed for me regarding preterism. I wanted to put together a study that was balanced and fair, and not just the textbook Assemblies of God material, which is very rapture and 7-year tribulation and just very dispensational minded. But in order to do that, I had to start digging into the other eschatological passages that the church was founded a lot of its beliefs on, the Daniel and the Olivet Discourse and Ezekiel, some of these places. And Daniel 12, when I got to Daniel 12 and read it in a way that I have never read it before, it stopped me in my tracks, literally. I came to a point where I had to stop studying and sort of step back and go, what have I just gotten myself into here? Because the things that I've always been taught are in the future. I'm seeing something in Daniel here that is not making sense about that. And then to make a long story short, I was able to teach them through Revelation from a pretty much a partial preterist perspective, where I found a balance that wouldn't shock people in it from who are deep into dispensationalism, but was able to show them how we're reading it and a lot finding fulfillment in a lot of these things that are talked about. But as I kept studying on my own after completing the study, I had crossed the Rubicon, if you will. There was no turning back for me. And I needed to tell the senior pastor about that, because everything that I was going to be doing in the fellowship now was going to change, especially the teaching.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so
here comes the issues.
Right. And this is what happened. I called him up and I told him, look, man, I've got some different ideas and I need to talk to you about them. And he said, well, okay, send me some info, some of your thoughts, how you got here, and we'll talk about it in a couple of weeks. A couple of weeks went by. We met in his office, and it took him all of 45 minutes to cut ties with me, our fellowship. And
geez, man, it's not a race.
He then proceeded to call it. Oh,
right.
I was a little, from an AG perspective, I expected it in terms of what would be his struggles to accept anything that I said. But I think it was what happened that provided sort of the scar, if you will. He proceeded to call everyone in our fellowship individually and basically told them that I was a false teacher and that they needed to leave, and insisted that he do that before I have a chance to address any of them. And it just kind of turned into a little bit of a mess.
I am wondering, because I, of course, I'm not religious, but I know the struggles that preterists have when they change over and how bad some of them can be and are. I'm trying to imagine what I would have to do to a relationship in my life to inside for like what is extreme enough to, in 45 minutes, get them not only to break their relationship with me, but to tell everybody they know and feel they have power over not to have a relationship with me. Like, that is the wildest response to anything ever. You would have to, like, punch a man's wife.
Andy, it seems like it's as much as we've done these testimonials, and this is so repetitive.
Oh, yeah,
this
you hear
story,
that a lot. Yeah.
It's like it has to be in a pastoral handbook. It's like in that section that's not physically printed, but is handed out.
That's about right.
And they say, okay, when you have a member come to you with these ideas, this is the steps by what you do is what you immediately disconnect. You immediately write everybody you know a letter and tell them how bad that person is with what they're thinking about, and you excommunicate them.
Well, and I'll say this to Zach. Zach, just so you understand, when Andy started that, Andy is an atheist. So what he's saying is like, what would I have to do in my life
exactly.
to get other people to just cut me off? You know, for us, like, we're in this.
What severity of crime would I have to commit?
Yeah.
I can tell you in my life, and I'm not a preterist, just for full disclosure, Zachary, but I challenged my mother's narrative of reality versus her reality. And it was all of 30 minutes before she said, I don't want to speak to you anymore, and then proceeded to call every sibling, aunt, uncle, cousin, and then went on Facebook and blasted it.
Which had nothing to do with faith, I guess. It's something
had nothing
else.
To do with faith, no.
Right. So it's just about what people feel strongly about, I guess, right?
It's almost like a thought crime, if there ever was such one.
A thought crime. I like that. I think that's good.
It's like the,
let's make a t-shirt.
It's like the highest level of heresy of that you could ever do is have a thought crime against somebody else.
But it's very unique. So, like, what Zach is saying, first of all, Zach, I didn't even know that about your story. So, that's
news to all of us.
I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I was introduced to him as an author, and I had no idea that he had something similar with Joel Rosenauer. But that makes sense why Dawson made the connection.
Extremely or Joel parallel made the
connection
to each other.
And all this. Joel made the connection. But because it's so common, I see this a lot now. I'm trying to figure out exactly, like, what scriptures are they using to make this decision. I imagine it's got to be something that Paul says in the Bible, like, for those, you know, do not even eat with them. Things like, you know, there are scriptures where it kind of like there was a man in the Corinthian church that was sleeping with his mother-in-law. And so he says, hand him over to Satan, right? So they send him out of the church, hand him over to Satan. So what scriptures, I wonder, Philetus are all of these pastors?
What's the two magicians? Hymenaeus and Philetus?
They weren't magicians. They were Judaizers. You're talking about the Judaizers that believe the resurrection was in the past?
Yes.
Yeah, those are just Judaizers. They weren't magicians.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is a third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly, and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
But it's kind of like those named people that are the people that
the wolves in sheep's clothing, the false teacher. He just mentioned the false teacher. They called him a false teacher. They made him into, and we've talked about, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing are not members of the congregation. They're actually leaders of the congregations. But, you know, they probably use that kind of language.
Yeah.
But if you truly believe something, and someone challenges that narrative and you're not willing to listen to what he has to say or search the scripture for yourself, then obviously you don't want that person teaching in your church. Mm-hmm. But it should take more than 45 minutes and more than one conversation.
Yeah, agreed.
Just in general.
I'm going to be super fast because I want to hand this back. I think it's just fear. I think they've looked down that. I think they see a darkness. I think they don't understand it. I think that leads to hell. And they won't go back because they're scared of what they see ahead of them.
Well, there is a difficulty. You have to admit there is a difficulty because I went through it too as I was, in my phase of study, where I started realizing that the words and the way that I defined them were actually incorrect. And that's what surprised me. Like what I always, you know, you go to a funeral and they say, this person who has died, where do they go? What do most people believe? Heaven, right? If they're believers, they go to heaven.
Right, everybody does. Everybody.
Yeah, like so when you die,
especially if it rains at your funeral.
Right. Right. So if you're at a Christian funeral and it doesn't matter if you're dispensationalist or not, the idea is when you're dead you went to heaven. Now, where did you go? Were you with Christ and then you're going to come with him when he returns or what? Some people believe that's possible you could be in soul sleep or whatever. I guess my point is that if you see things as fulfilled, that puts you in a very weird place because now you have to say the new heaven and new earth are here, you have to say that the resurrection has occurred. You have to say a lot of things and that's not the hope of most, because when they're studying or whenever they're at church, the hope is defined. So then and that was my hope that was defined was that
audibly nodding in agreement.
Yeah. Beyond this life that there's something that's going to go forward and then we're either going to come back with the Lord. I had somebody ask me, are you telling me that my daughter isn't coming back on a horse with Jesus? You know? And I'm like, oh, you know, like it's so hard. Like, you know, to talk about, well, we're talking about symbology, but I don't want to ruin your life. That's not what I'm trying to do. You know what I mean? Like,
don't ask me that hard question.
So that's the feeling, you know. But anyway, we hear this a lot, Zach. Like, we've heard this a lot.
on the bright side, they could have spent 6 months doing that, and that sucks a lot worse, I think, than 45 minutes. As bad as that 45 minutes hurt, imagine dragging that out for half a year.
Yeah, I guess
year.
It's true. They ripped the Band-Aid off, Zach.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I think I would have just appreciated at least maybe he, because he and I grew close, you know, obviously going to church together for nearly 10 years. I served on his board as well. He served as senior pastor. I mean, there was some closeness there, obviously. And I think it just would have felt wiser to me as a leader for him to spend some time with me on this, even if it was just a month and we meet once a week, just kind of talking about the topics. I'll bring some things to his attention and he can refute them if he wants. But it's just, I think it's like you said, there's an element of fear where they have to protect the institution. And for the Assemblies of God, they're very, very high on ecclesiastical authority. You know, the pastor of your church in the bylaws is the CEO of the corporation, and they are the shepherd of the flock, and they are the vision casters. And you as the congregants are to follow your vision caster, your shepherd. And so in doing so, it's his job to sort of protect the flock and protect the institution. And the Assemblies of God has some very, very stern and strict beliefs on things. And when you veer in there with something that they're not used to, it does shock them, in all honesty.
Well, that's, I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, I think that would be true for any, you know, church, especially, you know, whether it's Baptist, they all have their ecclesiastical, you know, hierarchy, the way things that work.
Right.
But even the church did, they had apostles, you know, and these apostles wrote letters and then passed them out. And then you had those that were bishops and elders or deacons, you know, that there's always been that government that was placed in the church. That's understandable. But I shouldn't be surprised, but you just kind of wish, if it was like you're saying, this person that you knew so well, that you'd grown close to over 10, you know, a decade of your life, to at least, you know, will you let me show you how I've come to this conclusion? If you see something as incorrect, the scriptures are what you're going to use. I mean, the scriptures are provided for reproof and correction and teaching.
Right.
You know, would you have given him the time to take the scriptures and try to show you why you were in error? Like, would you have given him that option?
Yeah. I mean, part of what I wanted to do with him was to simply engage another minister who's been in, he's been in the ministry for upwards of 25, 30 years. And so even to just engage him on how I've gotten to this point and knowing that his experience, he could provide for me other perspectives. Let's talk about the language here. Let's talk about the context here. Here's how I've always understood it. Things of that nature. The dialogue is what I appreciate most. And I would have given him his due respect in terms of his experience and the number of years he's been in ministry. Ultimately, I would have defended myself because I've gotten to this point. But either way, it's like you said, the thing that you want to do is to create this open dialogue where you two can still be brothers in Christ, but talk about a potentially difficult topic together. And the moment we stop learning, and even now that I'm a full preterist, I'm not saying that I have all the answers to the questions that full preterism has to answer.
Mm-hmm. You would be the first.
Some of those questions are very difficult, admittedly.
only the first of those that she's met. That's not true for about the other hundreds of us. We don't have all the answers. But you're right. I mean, that's a great point. We don't. But that's the other side of this, is all we've been asking for is, can we have a seat at the table? Can we have this discussion? Can you please understand we're not doing this because we like to be rebellious? This isn't rebellion. We've developed right. This. We see this. And once you do, it's hard to unsee it. So it's like, if you're going to correct, I've got to be corrected, and you're going to have to use the scriptures to do it, because that's what all of our right. churches agree on. We give the Bible such authority. And so since it is an authority in our lives, then you know, you're going to have to come at me with that, and I'm going to openly listen to it. My mind changes all the time. It happens. But this one is one, there are certain areas that, you know, it's a hill to die on, and it's, you know, it's tough. It's tough. It's a tough place to be.
Well, it's interesting. And I could sit and think, and as you're talking about what's going on, Zach, and how you wanted a one-on-one dialogue, and the thing, and I'm only speculating on his part completely, would be that he gave the amount of time that you wanted for him to read it. He can't answer the question, so what do we typically do coming from those positions? We begin to ask questions because we don't know where to go to find answers. So we go to our elders and we go to other pastors and say, hey, I got a letter from a guy in my church. He has these points of view. He doesn't really give any information per se, but then immediately what's discussed is about the whole context of that, well, this sounds like false teaching. This sounds kind of off kilter. There's got to be something wrong here. And then there maybe is the discussion about, you know, what to do, and we don't need his ideology or his thoughts being spread to other members. It could cause a problem. Then immediately then there's becomes that the executive order of action that he handed down. I think, and if you could have been able to have that one-on-one conversation with him like you wanted, that you could have presented the same thing that you developed for yourself reading through the text. But sadly, most people, because of, like Andy mentioned, the immediate fear that they have, they don't give it the amount of time. They don't have the inquisitive mindset. They are such on a track that they just keep going on the same trail. That it's hard to make a turn and go up a hill and go across, you know, the rocks or the rivers and stuff that you went through doing the study that any full preterist would have done and worked through the hard stuff. I just don't think he gave the time. If he would have, or it had been inquisitive at all, or the timing was right, or anything that would have presented in a different way, you'd have probably won him over.
Yeah, and he admitted to me that he didn't get a chance to go through all the notes that I had sent him, but he did mention that he called a couple of close pastor friends of his. However, these are all friends within AG that he learned from growing up himself. So the sources that he went to get a second opinion on it were telling him what he already wanted to do. And they were basically telling him, just reinforcing what he needed to hear. And he summarized his conversations with them, but they basically thought I was crazy. And there's nowhere that ever teaches this anywhere, you know, and it just reinforced his mindset that, yeah, I can't be dealing with this. I can't let this seep into my church. We got to deal with this, you know? So,
well, you know what, though?
That might have contributed to how quickly it went.
Yeah, and at some level, you have to say it's okay. That's okay, because Andy and I, we were talking, I can't remember, maybe a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about how sometimes it's like community is more important than the truth.
Right.
Remember that talk, yep, Andy?
We sure did.
Yeah. Yeah, and we did, sure. Like, for, and I'm not saying that about your pastor, I'm in particular. I'm just saying that a lot of times that having the community is more important. Because if you were to find something, because you have to understand, and I know you do, Zach, is that what we believe to be the truth is not the genuinely held belief of the church for 2,000 years. But you follow me, right? It's a pretty radical look at the scriptures, of which I believe, but sure. It's hard to believe it because you think, God, how is it? So what, the whole church has been wrong for 1950 years? Like, is that what happened? You know, is that even feasible? But then I've learned a lot of things historically. I've learned there's some things that they saw as fulfilled back then and things that our church never even discussed. So it's tough. That's a tough pill to swallow. So he's protecting his community.
Community affects your life minute by minute, every single day.
Yes.
Your belief in the end times will never affect your life.
Yeah. It should.
Well, I mean, say you're a Christian,
yeah,
right? You go through your life as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Does your belief in end times is not going to affect your behavior further than that? And your behavior is dictated by the fact that you're a Christian, not which version of the end times you believe in.
That's a pretty wide swath. That's not true. Yeah, because it's not true for everyone. I know people, again, we've talked about this, people who have decided to not go to college and to get married. It's affecting their life. Yeah. It's the idea of the end times coming and wanting to speed it up. But look, probably for most people, that's accurate. But not for those that are in like this, what I like to call like severely dispensational, the ones that are just like watching every minute and talking about it all the time, or that are all up into these prophecy stuff. You know, there's other things in the Bible besides prophecy. There's other things in the Bible besides eschatology. You don't have to focus on that, right?
Do you think there's less of that end times obsession than there was when we were growing up in like the 80s and early 90s?
I don't know.
Because it was like, I remember, I feel like it was bigger then. Like you'd hear
I remember it as a kid, but I also grew up in this area. We've talked about that, you know.
Well, I grew up in upstate New York.
Right.
And I remember, like, it's not like something that was happening locally, but it would hit the news, like somebody.
I mean, there was the whole Left Behind crowd, right?
I never heard it growing up. And I went to church.
Yeah.
I never heard it growing up. But I grew up in South Carolina, Southern Baptist Church.
You mean at a church. I just mean in the air. No, I mean, I just like mean some in general, guy on when television.
We have people come and say, so did the late great planet Earth thing. I was like, never heard of that. Some Glenn Hill talked about some book from John Hagee. I was like, I've heard of John Hagee, but never heard of that. I had just never heard of it. I guess I missed 1988. Yeah. I was in eighth grade listening to some Def Leppard.
We got out of school, bro.
Televangelism through the 80s and early 90s was major.
My parents watched Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers. We didn't watch
any of that. I did watch that too.
Hey, y'all.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is the third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
You're right. And Zach, you probably don't know, you don't know this. We've had this conversation numerous times. And I grew up in a very fundamental church where rapture talk was happening every service. And Sarita grew up in a church where, even though it was Southern Baptist, she never heard this stuff. So it's kind of like,
I didn't know about the rapture until Left Behind. It was the first time I had any. I was like, what is this? This is craziness.
Yeah,
but I liked the books. I read them. They were very interesting, just like I would read any Tom Clancy novel.
Harry Potter.
It was very engaging. It was very well written. I got involved with the characters. The movies were really crappy. I thought they could have done a better job with those. But like, I didn't know, and I really just didn't study it. It really just wasn't affecting my day-to-day ministry, my day-to-day walk with Christ, what I did at my church with evangelism explosion and things like that, going out and meeting people and telling them the gospel and ministering to women who've had abortions, and that none of that filtered in, and it wasn't important to me.
Right.
It was important to me where they went when they died. That's important.
Yeah.
But
well, see, that
it wasn't until later in my Christian walk that it became important. And then I guess I kind of was a dispensationalist until I met you guys, and I'm not that anymore, but I'm not preterist. So.
Yeah. Well, but see, that's the thing that's always been remarkable about Sarita to me is that what we talk about as full preterists, like when, like, for example, at the conference that I was just at, you know, they're doing studies, you know, trying to show, it's almost like, let's prove full preterism. Let's prove it. And that's fine. Bob Cruickshanks was talking about how do we live?
Yes.
Like live. And that kind of life and the things that he's describing is actually what Sarita's doing. So it's kind of like it doesn't matter what you believe about the eschatology. You're living the Christian life.
Because I was
you're
told to be Christian, like Christ.
That's right. So you're living
Christ
the life.
Christ was serving people. Christ was loving people. Christ was rebuking people when necessary.
Yeah.
And it was usually the religious people. It wasn't like the tax. He was like, come here, Matthew.
You almost said upper class. You should have just went for it.
Yeah. It was the religious rulers.
Yeah.
That's who he was. I mean, he didn't even get in Pontius Pilate's face. Like, he only got in the Sadducees, the Pharisees' faces. Mm-hmm. And he didn't say, hey, Matthew, you're the most horrible person. You've cheated. You've done this. He's like, come here, Matthew. I love you.
Right.
Repent from your ways And he did it in such a way that Matthew wanted to do those things mm-hmm. and make reparations for what he had done. And that's the kind of person, Christian, I wanted to be like. And eschatology doesn't fit into that mm-hmm. for me.
Right.
So was I polishing brass on a sinking ship, as Glenn Hill likes to say? Maybe. Maybe not, but I was doing what I thought was most Christ-like.
Yeah, and I don't, and again, try, you know, if you're spending your time proving your narrative.
Arguing on Facebook about.
Proving the narrative. Proving the narrative.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just to piggyback on what you guys are talking about here. I tried to close my book, Unveiled, with a section called What Do We Do Now? So there's all this talk in full preterism and really in every denomination about what the end means for people. And so after the whole thing was said and done, I tried to close the book by saying, well, now that everything has been fulfilled, what does that look like for Christians? And that's like the never ending question that they ask. What's the point of anything then if it's all been fulfilled? And basically what I try to conclude is exactly what you guys are talking about in terms of, you know, what I talk about is what the kingdom of God really looks like, you know, and the church out of one side of its mouth decries how bad the world seems to be getting. And out of the other side of its mouth, they say, but the world has to get this bad or Jesus will never come back. It's all part of the eschatology.
You know, there's some of those
and
people
it all
for
gets
sure.
kind of jumbled and mixed. And when you have that view that you're just waiting for God to lay waste to everything, admittedly, it does have even a slight effect on sort of how you see the things around you. So that was just to kind of piggyback off, you know, how do we live now in the midst of all this?
Yeah, that's what I was saying is that Sarita's worried about that. Like, she's just living it. Like, she's living in the kingdom, and she's working in the kingdom. She's doing all of the work, right? That's what we're all talking about, and like, this is what you should do. And she's out there doing, right?
Right.
I'm not saying you, Zach. I'm just saying that
right.
she's out there doing this, working at crisis pregnancy centers, ran for, you know, state House of Representatives and won. And she's, you know, she's good. What, next month? 2 months? 2 months?
68 days.
68 days, she'll be sworn in. So, like, just making these efforts to live in the world and to do the things that she believes that Christ would have her to do. That's what right. we're all talking about. We just need to put our feet to the pavement and get to work.
So, after he excommunicated you and cut you off from everything you'd known for a decade, what did you do then?
Well, I shook his hand and we exchanged an embrace. I mean, as we could, you could tell that he was troubled. But basically, I had a chance to explain everything to the fellowship of people that was with us after he had talked to them. And I basically spent a Sunday morning service trying to succinctly run through how I had gotten to this point. And everybody left except one family. And they believed what I was saying, and they appreciated the teaching. So they stuck with us. We tried to do the Sunday morning thing for as long as we could. We actually had two new families show up and begin fellowshipping with us as well. And they seemed to have embraced what I've been teaching as well. But now it's turned into more of a Friday night Bible study where it's every couple of weeks we get together, we have supper together, we engage each other, just check on each other. And then I have something prepared for a lesson, but it's a free and open forum where anybody can just talk about anything. And that's where we are now.
Wow. So
you don't go to a regular church fellowship on Sundays at all, or do you?
We have a church that we attend when we're able. You know, we have things that, you know, we softball leagues in the summer times, you know, things that keep us from going. But we don't feel tied to the Sunday morning experience anymore like we used to. Hmm. So it's not a, oh, we have to get ready and go to church. Hurry up, everybody. It's, you know, let's go this Sunday. Or, well, everybody's tired. We can stay home and we don't feel guilt about it. But we do have a church that we attend when we do go to church. It's just not, we're not going to commit to churches anymore where we take the membership class and sign a document saying, yes, we believe this and we believe that. So we're kind of out of that phase of our life, but we are staying as connected as we can to others for the sake of fellowship.
Sure. Do you have children?
They play softball.
I do.
Somebody plays softball.
I think I caught that too.
I got four little girls. Yep.
I had two girls play softball and both got college scholarships to play. And I understand that Sunday softball. Woo.
Oh man, it really is fun when it's going strong.
But they're both serving the Lord now, so
good.
Zach, so let's talk about that book. So I'll put the links, guys. If you go into the description of the podcast, you'll find the links at the bottom of it. But the one I want to talk about is Unveiled. When did that come to be? So obviously from what you've told us is that you guys wanted to study Revelation. So you started doing that. Is that whenever this started to develop in your mind, or did that come much later?
So the appointed time book was the product of my original study of Revelation that I taught on for the Sunday morning service. The Revelation book Unveiled, after engaging so many people on this topic and seeing how quickly this topic escalated, you know, I don't want to say contentious, but obviously the relationship with my senior pastor, I could now see how serious a topic this was for some people. And I know in the church today, there is a lot of intrigue in the book of Revelation. Everybody seems to think that we are the generation that's going to see it all, like every generation that's come before us. And there are books galore. And I just see things kind of going crazy. And I see the church sort of feeding into it instead of calming it down. And so after finishing that study on Revelation and the book on Daniel, I wanted to contribute to the preterist movement, if you will, in the only way I know how. I'm not really the best door-to-door evangelist, but I am a writer by my nature. And in my master's program, they teach you how to read and research and find sources and write and put it all together. And so I felt the Lord guiding me to a place where I could finally use everything that I'd learned. And so everything surrounding Revelation with the church, I decided to go ahead and tackle that and make my contribution to the preterist community. And the thing that I wanted to separate it from the other Revelation commentaries was I'm trying to tell it as a story. I feel like the commentaries are often, you know, here's this verse, here's the explanation, here's the next verse, here's the explanation. And that's fine in terms of, I just need to look this up real quick. But I feel like telling Revelation as a story, almost like Left Behind did, but mine has scholarship behind it, is what I wanted to do. And so I feel like that would keep people engaged with it while being able to track through the book of Revelation and sort of put it all together. So that's kind of how I wanted to separate it, just to turn it into easy reading, as difficult a book as it is.
Yeah, that was an undertaking, turning Revelation into an easy read book.
Yeah. Yes.
Something that Andy could read.
Was it Cliff's Notes? Yeah. Cliff's Notes to Revelation.
Yeah.
Unraveling the chiastic language there.
Yeah. Well, we've been learning about that. Sarita taught us about that last time. So what are you going to do now? So guys, if you go to the product description, like I said, you can link to that book to see. It's pretty, I flipped through it. I haven't read it all yet, Zach. I started flipping through it and I can see what you mean. It's definitely not an exegetical study. It's more of a narrative. It's, you know, and it's really good so far. So I was like, that's an interesting take. So what are you doing now? Are you writing anymore, or going to try to get this, push this book out, or what you doing?
Yeah, I need a break from writing. My mind is fried. With four young kids, the only time I can really write is from about 9:30 p.m. until about 1 a.m. So after writing about two books over the course of 3 years like this, it's time for a break. So I've been happy just telling people about this book and marketing it in whatever way that I can. And obviously, it's been a joy being able to share a little bit of it with you guys and talk about it. You guys have an amazing thing going on here. So I certainly appreciate just giving me a little bit of a forum here to tell a little bit about myself and the work that has been a labor of love. So
yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I know what you mean about being burnt out. I've talked about this the other day with Rick. I was like, man, I'm so burnt out. Like, I want to quit the podcast. Oh, I have those moments where constantly. I'm just so tired of this. And then we went to that conference and so many people, they were so nice. And they said,
they injected us with the eschatology drug. And
they were like, we love you. Oh, we're so glad you're there. And we listen and all this. And they were asking about everybody.
We record every day.
It was such a sweet thing. So it's going to give me enough power to make it at least till January. But as soon as Sarita goes to the house, I don't know what we're going to do.
Don't blame me.
I'll blame you if we collapsed because you. Yes. No. Zach, it's been really great. I'm glad you've been here. I want to, Sarita, will you ask him the final question that we normally ask our guests?
Sure. Normally, Billy asks this question, but I'll ask it today, and I don't have his deep, sultry voice. But when you die, you take your last breath on this earth, what happens next? Where do you go?
Oh my. Well, even as a full preterist, I still believe in when Paul talked about his necessity in remaining on in the flesh for the people's sake. You know, would I rather be here in the flesh or would I rather be with the Lord? Well, of course, I'd rather be with the Lord, but for your sake, I'll remain on in the flesh as long as he tells me to. So my understanding of that is that if you're not here, you're with the Lord as a believer in Christ. I let go of my belief in hell a while back, but in terms of one's belief in Christ, I believe that when I die, I will go to be with the Lord, and that will be that's what I am. My hope.
Awesome!
Yay!
Great answer. All right, I appreciate that, Zach. Thanks so much for being a guest on here. Guys, go to the product description. I'll have the links for both of his books, and you can check out. Let me get those titles again. It was Unveiled. Actually, why don't you tell us the title, Zach, of the two books?
So the Revelation book is called Unveiled, first century narrative of John's revelation. And the other book is called The Appointed Time. There are two editions of it. So I gave you the link to the second edition here.
Okay.
But it's a narrative of, or it's a commentary on Daniel tying it to a narrative of the Olivet Discourse.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, Big Daddy.
Yeah.
Sarita.
Represent.
Tativ. Andy.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for being here. Zach, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks,
man.
Zach.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate that.
All right. Take care. And we will talk to you guys again next time on the Burrows of Berea. Peace out.
Bye, y'all.
Later.
Hey, guys. This is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. A lot of people have been asking us, hey, what is this Patreon thing? Our old Patreon ad didn't work very well. So here you go, guys. Go to www.patreon. That is patreon.com. Let me do that again. patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea. If you go to the Patreon page, you will find that we have different levels that you can give at. We have a $3 level, a $5 level, we've got a $10 level, and a $20 level. I thought about putting a $1,000 level there, but you never know how that's going to work out, right, Andy? That's right. So go to www.patreon.com/TheBurrows of Berea and give us all of your money.
even a little bit will be fine.
Yeah, and that $5,000 wouldn't hurt me.
No, it would hurt nobody.
Thanks, guys. Is it going to be a problem for you to go to like 7:10 tonight, Zach, to go over, or 6:10 for you? Another additional 10 minutes?
No, that's no problem.
Okay, great. Sorry to get started late. We had a lot of traffic issues.
No, that's totally fine.
That was one of the problems.
They're literally paving every stretch of road from Spartanburg to Hendersonville.
Yeah, it's brutal.
I can't account for South Carolina, but I know on the North Carolina side, it should probably only take 15 to 20 years.
It'll take 20 to 30 on South Carolina side.
Yeah.
That's why I ran on fixing DOT roads and why I won. So there you go.
Yes. All right. You guys ready? You ready, Zach?
Every season is road construction up here.
Oh, yeah.
I'm ready.
All right.